Hi, everyone. So this is Milo Jones. I assume, Milo, that you're in Warsaw, Poland. Is that right?
I am indeed.
As you can tell, with a very, very strong Polish accent. You'll hear more of that Polish accent in a second. But Milo is an academic. He's a professor, but he's also one of the most profoundly practical people that I know. And so when you find somebody who matches intellect with practical action, it's worth paying attention and potentially even be fearful. Milo has a background in the US Marines, but he's also an intelligence expert. He's written a book called Constructing Cassandra and has contributed and written many white papers and contributed to journals and the like. And Milo showed up in my life in a way that he'll probably explain at my ValueX conference. And so, with that short and incomplete introduction, Milo, how did you come into my life and what parts of that introduction did I totally screw up?
Guy, you did everything perfectly, as everyone can tell. I have a thick Polish accent by way of the Upper East Side of New York. But I do live in Warsaw now, and I came into your life when I was living in Poland, and I was finishing my PhD, and I was miserable. Nothing was going right. I was pissed off with myself and life in general. I really seemed to be becalmed in every way, and I thought, you know what? Pull yourself together, take action, cast your bread upon the waters. So I literally Googled something like European investment conferences or something I could attend or do or contribute to change my life. And to a shocking degree, first of all, I then found you and ValueX. I think it was the second time you'd ever run. So it was pretty early in things, but I sort of wrote you in a very broad request saying, "Hi, I sometimes teach finance and I'm interested in value investing, and here's who I am and here's what I do. Will you have me?" And you were kind enough to say yes. And it's really been for me such a rich experience over so many years. I've made so many friends and developed so much personally and professionally. It is now my object lesson to people about the power of every once in a while, if you're discontent, use it. Take some chances, meet some new people, and sooner or later something good comes of it. You and ValueX have been an object lesson for me in that approach to life.
That's extraordinarily kind, Milo. It's also a lesson for me. It's an early lesson, this idea of using the algorithm for your interests. When you put something out there, you attract people into your life. But and thank you for the short advertisement for ValueX, which I did not intend, but of course I'm not against it. But tell us a little bit about how somebody growing up on the Upper East Side ends up in the Marines and then ends up in Poland.
Sure. Well, when I was 8, we moved from the Upper East Side to the middle of America, a state called Wisconsin, famous for its cows. But my parents promptly sent my sisters and me off to boarding school, they in Maryland and me in Virginia. My boarding school was all boys. And even the teachers were men. I had one female teacher in high school. She taught typing. So I got to Northwestern and was determined to meet girls. So I majored in art history. And I knew I would be going in the Marines because I had taken Russian in high school. I was very committed to this was Reagan's America. I was very committed to my country. And my school very much reinforced the idea to whom much is given, much is expected. And the Marines were supposed to be the best. So I joined the Marines. And Marines didn't care what you majored in, so art history was a great major. And I have to say, the Marines also had the benefit of making my parents, on the one hand, proud, but on the other hand, somewhat unhappy. And I was at an age where, you know, pulling the levers to assert independence and make your parents unhappy is a good thing. I really found, though, that nothing enriched my life more than what amounted to a total of 8 years and then a bit afterwards being associated with that group of people, because the ability to make an important contribution to a constructive cause is probably the best route to happiness I know. It is certainly not, it's certainly better than lying on a beach sipping a cocktail, as many people think.
And so you spent 8 years at the Marines.
4 years training in college, then 4 years after. The training in college included things like attending the Army's Airborne course, and of course, Marine officer selection. So it was fairly intense, although obviously the rest of the time I was just a happy-go-lucky college student.
And so
then 4 years active duty that included service during, we didn't know to call it the first Gulf War, we just called it the Gulf War at the time. Although I never got anywhere near the Middle East. I was sent to Asia to keep the North Koreans thinking there were a lot more Marines left in Asia than there were. My specialty was all Marine officers trained to be infantry officers, and then you learn a specialty, and I was selected for communications, or the British would say signals.
Signals, isn't that a lovely word? You know, I'm fascinated and want to ask questions like what exactly, but I'm also aware of the statement that Milo would tell me, but then he'd have to send people out to kill me. So I'm not sure how deep I want to go, because clearly, you know, one way is to call it signals, another way is to just call it intelligence. And I've developed a much greater interest. I've got some water coming my way here in intelligence, because I think that much of what we do as investors is, gather intelligence and gather insight from organizations and situations which don't necessarily give up that insight easily. And I'm looking forward to, and for those who are interested, Milo, I've not done the course, but Milo has a course on Coursera, which is all about intelligence analysis, intelligence tools for a digital age, which makes so much sense to me. And it's a fascinating topic. But I don't know if where I want to lead you is either to your academic career after your military career, and or a discussion of, and obviously we can't dive into the whole book, but you know that you're constructing Cassandra and the discussion of the intelligence failures of the United States, which seem to have been manifest. I don't know. I'll give you that fork and let's see where you take it.
Okay. I think you're completely right that what intelligence agencies seek is not what people think. This is not about collecting secrets for their own sake. Finally, intelligence agencies are there to provide an information advantage to decision makers. And what investors are always looking for is an information advantage. What really interested me was the degree to which there was no clear consensus around why intelligence failures happen. There were various silos of explanation. Some people say it's a psychological problem. Other people would say, no, it's about bureaucratic politics. Other people would say, no, it's quite specifically about biases. There's a general screw up theory of intelligence. So there are all these failures, but particularly after 9/11, what really got me was people were latching on to a theory first put forward by a woman named Roberta Wallstetter, who's very clever, that said intelligence failures happen because, at essence, they're failures of imagination. That after a surprise, you can almost always find in the data you'd already collected enough information not to have made that mistake. But because you haven't interrogated the data correctly, you make the mistake. So ultimately, your failure to imagine how you should be interrogating reality is what creates the failure. It's not, oh my gosh, we didn't have the right guy sneaking around stealing the right secrets.
And just to anchor this a little bit, so the most clear example of that I know of is that the US had all the information it needed to apprehend the 9/11 terrorists. They had information that they were associated with radical Islamic groups. They had information that they were taking flight courses. They had all that information. It was connecting the dots that didn't happen.
right? That they had people from the flight courses calling the FBI and saying, hi, we have these guys from the Middle East who keep showing up, paying cash, learning how to take off in a big jet, learning how to fly it, but then they quit the course before they learn how to land.
Right.
Should we be concerned? And unfortunately, those dots were not connected. But after 9/11, you again and again heard this phrase, well, it's a failure of imagination. And politicians love that phrase because it's plausible. It's even true. But best of all, there's no one to blame.
Right.
And there's no action you need to take. So my work
tried
to get to the root of where do failures of imagination come from?
Right. And before I start diving some rabbit hole or another, for the person who is sitting in their car and wants to know the bottom line of the book and doesn't have the time to pull it off the shelf and read it, can you sort of give the highlight bottom lines, conclusions that they would get to?
Sure. Essentially, intelligence failures happen either in business or in the Central Intelligence Agency. They have at their root questions of culture and identity, and that who you are as a person, an analyst, who you are as an organization, shape what questions you ask and what answers you find. And that often it's not a complete inoculation against failure, but often diversity in an analytic group is actually worth the trouble. Diversity is often billed as a good in itself or a moral imperative, and it may be those things. But it is also an important part of analyzing complex problems because everybody, based on who they are and where they come from and the language they speak their gender and their religious identity, come at the world a different way. And asking all of them to contribute to the framing of important problems is worth the trouble.
Yeah,
and my country struggles with that for lots of reasons.
Well, what's so incredible is that the United States, from my perspective, does not struggle with diversity as it's most commonly identified. And usually we're talking about the sort of visual diversity. What I love about your point is that it's actually what we're looking for is cognitive diversity. And that doesn't even cover it. It's not just thinking styles. It's the person who has the background to examine a pattern of facts and say, that's totally something that somebody from my country might consider doing. Whereas somebody from the United States, no matter what the color of their skin, would not have the imagination to be able to do.
And current efforts to improve diversity in the intelligence community still define diversity in an extremely provincial way. America is 4% of the world's population with over 20% of the money. And we simply come at the world a certain way and really struggle the way many big cultures do to understand the points of view of people who do not, the rest of the 96% of the world that wasn't American. I have to say Edward Lookback has a somewhat offensive term, but I think it accurately describes this phenomenon. He calls it strategic autism. And he assigns a sort of strategic autism not only to the United States, but also to other big cultures like Russia or China, where the rest of the world is sending you signals, but key elements of your information processing network just don't receive the signal.
Fail to identify. It's funny, I was going to bring up Edward Lutfak. I forget how much we've talked privately about Edward. Edward was a guest in my parents' home in the south of France. And, just on a personal level, he's one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. Nobody I've met has ever been as well-versed in the history of pretty much every battle that ever seems to have happened.
And speaking 8 languages, and oh, by the way, his wife, Dahlia, is also an enormously talented and charming artist.
Yes.
I visited her studio in Maryland, and they are.
Yeah, I stayed with them once,
an incredible
actually.
Couple.
Their daughter was about my age, and so we had a friendship with a number of friends together, and you know, in some versions of my life, he might have ended up a member of my family, which would have been interesting. And he has this endearing video with his grandchild now, where he's getting the grandchild's expert opinion. But Edward Luttwak became famous for writing something, a book. I'm going to recall it in a second. It was like how to conduct a coup. I think
a coup d'état, a practical manual,
which was required.
It's on the shelf behind me, and I met him because I gave a talk in Israel some time ago, a few years ago, called "Coup d'état: A Digital Manual," making the case that his book was analog and needed to be updated for the digital age, because if these days it's far more important to control the systems administrator of a smart city than it is to control, or it will be increasingly important to control the system administrator of a smart city rather than the local tank battalion commander.
Yeah.
What will Xi Jinping do when he shows up for work and his pass doesn't work, so to speak?
So and there's so much geostrategy and conversations about geopolitics that I is another rabbit hole that I very much want to get into. But I guess, and I'll just preview where we go there for the listener. There's this wonderful phrase that I will always associate with Milo that I still don't understand as fully as I would like, is this idea that the digital retrieves the medieval. But I'm just going to set that on the shelf for a second. Because I think that the question for somebody like me and anybody who does a job anything like mine of how do I get out of Milo and people like Milo insights into from the intelligence community on how to conduct investment research? And I guess I'll just throw the question to you like that. And so, you know, it's very easy, Milo. All you have to do is summarize your Coursera course in 3 minutes standing on one leg. But if you kind of like, you know, if 100% of your net worth was invested in people who are about to hear what you have to say and you want to give them the benefit of all of your insights and wisdom and you only got a few minutes to do it, you know, what can we learn? What can we investment analysts learn from the intelligence community?
I'm not going to give you one answer, but I'll try to give you some answers.
Yeah.
The first of which is, I believe passionately that this paradox that you're always surprised after the fact by the information you had to predict it, that the thing to take most seriously is not your information sources, but the quality of your questions. The quality of your question, the generation of the right hypothesis, should drive everything. In the intelligence community, we have something called, an idealization called the intelligence cycle, where you start with tasking, what do we want to know? That's actually often taken for granted in the investment world. Well, we want to see all the forms this company's filed with the SEC. We want to see the balance sheet. We want to see the P&L. Yes, you do, but what else do you want to see? So the framing of your question is far more important than having any exotic source of information, asking the right questions. And frankly, I find in the investment world, frequently it's the short sellers who are better at posing. I don't short anything most of the time, but I admire short sellers for their ability to really not just dig out unique sources of information, but ask the right questions in the first place. So ask the right question, step one. Step two, recognize among your subordinates that the most valuable thing they can often do in your research is to make your decisions harder and not easier. A good intelligence analyst is a gadfly, a real pain in the ass. You're trying to make a decision. You call in someone who's been researching that question for you for 2 or 3 days, and you say, tell me about X. And when they leave your office, your decision's harder and not easier. As a person, it's very difficult to adopt that discipline. But as a decision maker, you should be grateful for those people on your team who, without making things unnecessarily complex, do reveal many aspects of an issue that you failed to consider. So that's my second point. Quality of your questions, people who make your decisions harder, not easier. And then finally, you touched on this idea that we've talked about digital retrieving the medieval. I believe passionately that technologies are not neutral, culturally, politically, socially, that first we shape our technologies and then our technologies start reshaping us. And by us, I mean culture and values. And that new values create new sources of value. And as an investor, focusing on those societal shifts and the arbitrage between price, cost, and value that is happening under the impact of, I believe, accelerating digital change is going to be vital to making, well, at least asking the right questions of your portfolio in the future.
That's a fantastic summary. And there's, I mean, it's interesting. So framing the right question so I want to kind of dive down a little bit on each of those. So framing the right questions, obviously, and just to give the listener an example, I think that, for example, this guy, Chris Mayer, who attended ValueX at least one of the years and has written this book, Finding 100 Baggers, there's a great question. Is this potential to be a 100 bagger? I don't think that for the first 5 years of investing, I ever asked myself that question. At least to ask it, at least you're trying to do the right thing. But I want to dive into the second part where you're kind of talking about the quality of the organization that you're building around you and the quality of the interactions that you're building around you, assuming that you've already framed the right question. And so I'll just throw out two things which themselves could lead in all sorts of directions. I'm curious to see which one of them you pick up. You can pick up on both sequentially. So the one is this concept of OODA loops, which you'll enjoy that the first time I heard of OODA loops was when I discovered there was this man called Dominic Cummings who'd won the Brexit Leave vote, and he was writing on his blog about OODA loops. And then I read the book by Robert Boyd, and it seems to be a very powerful idea, but you've probably thought more about OODA loops than I have. And then the other place that kind of thing that came up for me is, Robert's rules of order, parliamentary rules of order. And, part of what I'm hearing you say is that the smallest, most insignificant voice in the room needs to be heard because they may actually have the insight. And if you build an organization around inadvertently suppressing that minority, less confident, less experienced person, not giving them a voice, you may be missing out on something. But so let's see where you go with those two possible avenues of exploration.
Sure. I can't tell you the degree to which OODA loops and John Boyd's thinking informed all the training I received as a Marine officer, because it informed something we called maneuver warfare, which is the way the current Marine Corps and the Marine Corps of my era, since they're now slightly different things, was tasked to fight. I am, however, uncomfortable going into too much detail because I am halfway through a devastating book called The Blind Strategist that makes a strong, quite compelling case that John Boyd got some things right, but got a lot wrong fundamentally, because he relied on British historians interviewing Nazi officers about how they'd done Blitzkrieg. And Mr. Fuller was one of the British historians, and Mr. Hart was the other one. And they effectively cherry-picked some of how Blitzkrieg worked, and therefore some of how maneuver warfare should work, and therefore some of how we should fight wars, and really bring into question the entire OODA loop John Boyd concept. So,
and I want to pause there because I just realized, sure, Milo, that The majority of the people, or many people listening to this, may not have heard of OODA Loop. So we should just pause talk them through. So why don't you just explain to the uninitiated what an OODA Loop is and what Robert Boyd's thinking was?
Sure. At the end of the Korean War, America faced a mystery. We had a ratio of about a 10 to 1 kill ratio against Soviet planes called MiGs. In other words, for every time there'd be a fight between planes, for every one time an American would get shot down, we'd shoot down about 10 Soviet MiGs. And at first, we were just pleased.
Yeah, I'm pleased by that.
But then people said, well, why is that? You know, the answer was, well, because we're Americans. Wasn't really satisfying everybody. So they said, well, let's think about how a dogfight between planes works. And think about what characteristics we'd want from a plane. You're going up to try to shoot down another plane. And everyone said, well, you want it to be fast. And we figured out, well, that's weird because Soviet planes were faster. And then we said, well, gosh, maybe it's a question of turning capability. And then we said, well, that's strange because everything we can tell, theirs turned better than ours did. And then people said, well, maybe it's about the armament. Well, no, sorry. Soviet planes were better armed than ours. So what was going on? They finally modeled how a pilot goes about a dogfight and came up with this idea that it's stylized as a loop that starts with observe, just look around at the world. And then when you spot an anomaly or something else, you understand as quickly as you can what that is. And then you make a decision, and then you take an action. So observe, understand, decide, act. And sometimes one of the U's is an O and so on, but that's the essence of the model. And what we realized is what was the reason the American planes were winning was they had two things that hadn't been considered important up to that, which was the cockpits were more comfortable, so the pilot could move around and look, and the windscreens were bigger, so they could see more. So the American planes had the decisive edge at the beginning of the OODA, the observation and understanding. And if they could then make quicker decisions and take quicker actions, they'd win the fight. So that's an OODA loop. It's a model of how people make decisions. And arguably, you know, every business decision you're making is in some sense informed by a loop. Somewhat like that. You're observing, you're understanding, you're taking decisions, and you're acting. And presumably, if you do that faster and more accurately than the competition, some combination of accuracy and speed matters, you'll succeed. The neatest way to define it, and maybe this is where I should have started, is if you run a faster OODA loop, it would be like playing chess against Garry Kasparov, but getting three moves on the chessboard for every one move Garry makes.
Right.
Even I might have a chance to at least work Kasparov to a draw under those conditions.
And there's this beautiful idea that I think must be in the book, in which your goal is to get inside your opponent's decision-making envelope. So it actually doesn't matter how fast your decision-making is happening, so long as it's happening at a faster rate than your opponent.
Exactly. Where this book, The Blind Strategist, is well, I haven't finished the book yet, but I have to say I've been sharing it with some of my fellow former Marines, and it's a fairly devastating read because it's taking apart a lot of the sort of strategic lore on which we were raised. So I'm hesitant to go too deeply any further into OODA loops, but I don't think they've been debunked, but they're being constructively questioned by today's military.
And I think that, look, I believe that it was, that concept was extraordinarily helpful for Dominic Cummings in running the Brexit campaign, because he had this idea in his mind that he had to get inside Remain's OODA loop decision-making. And I think that many successful political campaigns are run by surprising the opponents. The campaign with the initiative is moving faster and taking decisions faster. For what it's worth, in the investing world, One way to win in a dogfight is not to get into the dogfight. And so, you know, we know that, for example, shorting, which you said you also don't do, I think we'd both agree it has very short OODA loops. You need to be very reactive. You need to be very aggressive in the acquisition of new information. And I think there's some element of that analysis that helps me to move towards situations where it's got deliberately slow OODA loops, where there's plenty of time to make the decision. As I imagine it would be if we go away from jet fighting, dogfights, to two naval groups facing off against each other, there's probably an enormous amount of analysis because these things lumber along, and turning an aircraft carrier takes a matter of days. So time is shorter, even if it, very consequential decisions and enormous amounts of analysis and insight and prediction, but you've just got a more leisurely approach to the decision-making.
You do right up until the time shooting starts. But then, because everything is so platform dependent, you can win or lose an engagement in 30 seconds. And just to keep things contemporary, when people ask for something like, can't we just set up a convoy to escort Ukrainian ships carrying grain out of the Black Sea? We could put together such a convoy, and it could be properly armed and coordinated, but there may come a moment where literally there's a 30-second window where one of those ships will see missiles coming at them, and they won't know if it's a mistake, if their radar's got a problem, or if this is really Russia deciding to strike the convoy. And that 30-second window, that captain knows, is perhaps life and death for their crew, or World War III, or failure in the end of their career. Any number of those things could happen. So naval engagements indeed have slower OODA loops right until the time the shooting starts, and then whole platforms get sunk very quickly. Just ask the admiral in charge of the Moskva how quickly they had to make this. Sorry to get technical.
Yeah, no, there, that is there. But, so I can't wait to get there, because I have that. I find that so interesting and exciting, and my emotions are fully engaged there. But I'm going to not take the bait, although it's super interesting for now.
And well, may I interrupt, because I took a note. You did ask one interesting thing. One of the things the intelligence community really can offer investors is sets of frameworks for structuring long-term conversations about problems that can't be quantified yet. And you brought up this idea that you want to hear from everybody in the room. And it's often been my experience that if you are trying to decide something big and difficult to quantify, like, is China investable for us right now? The common approach is to have everybody read pros and cons, sit around a table, and argue about it. And I would predict that the Anglo-Saxon men are likely to carry the day in such an unstructured sit around the table, fight about it environment. What's great about many of these techniques, structured analytic techniques they're called, and anybody listening can Google a book called The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, which is an old CIA manual declassified. And you'll find many structured analytic techniques that can help you as an organization or an individual slow down, put some things up on a whiteboard, and give everybody time to reflect and contribute to analyzing competing hypotheses about what is actually going on and what you might do about it. And it's back to your idea that you want to be in an environment where the decisions are not relying on your ability to make decisions, sound decisions, more quickly than other people, but instead collect diverse views. So it's just a shout out to structured analytic techniques and their ability to really find the best in diverse groups of people, not all of whom are pushy and went to schools where debating was prized.
Of which, actually, Robert's Rules of Order is a first step. I mean, that is effectively a way of structuring a conversation, preserving minority views, ensuring people have been heard, But you're saying that there are far more, I guess, well thought out, advanced. I mean, in the book, and you know, funny enough, what came up for me with Edward Luttwak is that he has been recent on Twitter pointing out the intelligence failures of the CIA in Afghanistan. They predicted that the U.S. or the allies would last much longer there. And the opposite.
Yeah,
and here. Yeah, and then there's a post where he says that some group of people should be lined up and shot, which I thought was a little bit much, but he was angling for attention, I guess. But
Edward Luttwak is the sort of person who doesn't mind offending you, not for its own sake, but in service of more important points. Apparently, he recently went to the CIA, and he was supposed to give a talk about the Middle East. So he walked into the room and said, well, as long as we're talking about the Middle East, I thought I'd give the talk in Arabic. Is that okay? And of course, only something like a tiny minority of people in the room actually spoke Arabic.
Yeah.
And then he used that to make the point that, look, really? You think you can understand a sizable chunk of humanity without speaking their language? That's a very American approach to understanding the world. And you really need to spend less time on intercepting every call you can and more time on understanding the cultural context in which big decisions are being made about war and peace. No. And it's not something that America has traditionally done terribly well. One of the reasons we were convinced Pearl Harbor would not be attacked was because Japanese pilots were so short-sighted they would never master naval aviation. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, but at the same time, there's this incredible line in Bill Browder's recent book, Freezing Order, where he says, when you see somebody behaving irrationally, it's not because they're irrational or stupid. Most of the time, it's because you don't have complete information about them. And if you had more complete information, you would understand why within their environment, what they're doing makes sense. And, you know,
absolutely.
And the United States is a diverse country with many pluralist institutions that encourage diverse thinking and has universities, and you know, it's the least totalitarian country we know. So what is going wrong? And certainly there are people at the great defense departments of the United States who give the very best of their minds and of their lives to defending the free world, and still, you know, we in the free world, our representatives in the defense community seem to be getting it quite wrong. What's going wrong? I think that one of the things, it's easy to take pot shots, is just easy to say these damn people are so, but the people are not stupid, and they are highly intelligent and they care. So what I agree.
And I, one of the things that I've always made clear in all my writings is my writings are not gotcha writings. These are hard jobs, and I agree these people care. And I too believe deeply in certain values that these people defend, and I myself wrote a blank check with my life at one point to defend these values. However, Americans do not want to do the hard work of cultural analysis that is required by, for example, learning the languages, being in a place not that's good for your career for a year or two, but being in a place for decades, for years, building the relationships. Maybe at a cocktail party in Manhattan, you can parachute in for a few months and build a great network. But that's a strange place, actually. There used to be graffiti as you'd leave Manhattan saying, America starts here. And it's kind of true. But I would argue there should be graffiti as you leave the United States saying, the world starts here.
Yeah.
Let me give you a few basic examples. You and I, as investors and as capitalists and everything, we've been to business school. I think you went to Harvard Business School. I went to London Business School. And we learned that when you're hiring someone, you should give the job to the most qualified candidate. Well, you know what? For most of human history and in most of the world today, if you have a job to give away, it is immoral, it is indecent to apply some objective criteria about here are the characteristics we're looking for to decide whom we should give that job to. You have a brother-in-law, you have a cousin, they need a job, you give that job to them, period. It's you're literally a bad person if you don't do that. Now, you and I would label that corruption, but most of human history, most people for much of human history have said, no, that's actually both moral and common sense. You take care of your own before you take care of a stranger. So we're used to a very rules-based order, and we're also used to immense wealth. My country is a place where more than 90% of Americans below the poverty line have at least one air conditioner. And our poor people are fat. And there are parts in the world, there are much of the world where people live on $2 a day. And poor people certainly aren't fat because they can't literally afford enough calories. So how on earth are we going to understand the thought worlds as rich society, the thought worlds of the 2 or 3 billion people who will inhabit vast urban slums throughout the developing world and who will be looking at their phones, because they will have phones. They'll be looking at us and our beautiful lives, and they're going to, on one sense, want that, and in another sense, they're going to hate us. And I don't blame them, because there's another aspect, and that is that we assume the universality of our values. So we pump out wonderful things like the Gettysburg Address, the Constitution. We also pump out celebrity rehab, and they see that we spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on Halloween costumes for our pets, when maybe they had a sister who died of a curable disease, but we didn't give the aid to help them. So there are big disconnects between our lives and their lives, and rich people speaking one language, no matter how empathetic and committed, are not going to properly master the thoughts of those people.
So I'm going to put one more question to you before we dive into geopolitics. You know, there's this idea, I don't know who expressed it first, pay attention. It's actually Charles Darwin. Pay attention to the disconfirming evidence. You know, you're walking around with hypotheses that you don't even realize about how the world works. But if you could just pay attention to the disconfirming evidence, you will learn something. So, you know, I've learned that small steps lead to better steps. And I recently received in my email inbox from somebody I'd never heard of a short thesis on a company that I'm long. And, you know, I frankly did not think a lot of the analysis, but I knew I had to thank him and I knew I had to encourage that. So I'm aware enough to say to myself, what do I do to encourage more of that? So I reached out to him and I thanked him for sending me something, because you want to be a place where disconfirming evidence. But at the same time, you know, I imagine if we just go back to the beginning of our conversation, so flight schools calling up the FBI and saying, hey, we got these guys learning to take off but not learning to land. And that's one of 10,000 calls that month. And out of those 10,000 calls, you know, all the rest are from total kooks who are just trying to get attention. And so on the one hand, we, for example, want to pay attention to disconfirming evidence. We want to reach out to things that challenge our worldview. At the same time, if we give an audience to every single damn thing, every single conspiracy theorist, every single clue, we're going to be overwhelmed. So what's the answer? What's the best orientation based on your experiences in studying the intelligence universe?
Great question. Obviously the hard part. And that really is the essence of what I was writing about, because whereas my hypothesis was, if after a strategic surprise, you can find someone who gave intelligent warning and got ignored, what you have is not a failure of imagination. You have a problem with the sociology of knowledge.
Right.
You're not listening to the right people. And right. How do you solve that? And I found that, those problems are rooted in culture and identity. But as a practical matter, you're asking of all of us, how do we go around keeping in the front of our minds questions like, what could I learn that would make me change my mind? And I literally used to have that up as a sign in my desk. Signs don't work, but it was the occasional reminder to myself. And that, I know you're a fan of the Checklist Manifesto. I think the book even mentioned you. That should be on your checklist. What could we learn that would make us change our mind? And a variation of that, which is often good for penetrating deception, is if we are correct, what other evidence would we expect to see? And do we see it? So to give you an example from military history, when the Allies were trying to convince the Nazis that there was a whole extra army up in Northern England and Scotland waiting to invade at Pas-de-Calais, and that D-Day is just a feint, a farce, they had to somehow convince the Nazis that there were all these soldiers. And of course, they did things like dummy tanks, and General Patton was stationed up there and so on. But they also said, what would the Germans expect to see if there really are hundreds of thousands of troops in Northern England? And they realized that, among other things, they would expect to see wedding announcements in the local paper in the months leading up to the invasion. And so they placed hundreds of fake wedding announcements in local papers throughout England and Scotland of local girls falling in love with non-existent soldiers just to convince the Nazis that there's this non-existent army. So you can also use that question, what would I expect to see and do I see it, as part of a deception planning operation. But not, then we're getting way off. I presume that very few investors need to create a deception plan.
I don't, but I think it's, you know, I think that some company managements are engaging in deception without realizing it. It's, I don't want to attribute bad intent, but if they're getting rewarded for putting up a mirage of what the investors want to see, then they're engaging in a kind of deception. And actually, they inadvertently start finding things to put into their presentations to investors that will confirm that pre-existing bias.
Absolutely. So you want to interrogate anomalies, ask what could you learn that would make you change your mind, and ask yourself, if our hypothesis is correct, what else would I expect to see? All of this, as I say, the book is by Richard Shure. It's called The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis. It's free. It's declassified. Don't buy it. Google it. You can get a PDF. And chapter 8 will walk you through a framework called the analysis of competing hypotheses, which is really what every investment is, right? It's a hypothesis. And you want to get good at penetrating deception if it's occurring in your world. And that's what it was originally designed for.
You know, there's one, I'm not going to mention the company, but because some of my dear friends hold a lot of it, but the CEO of that company provides what I feel like is too much information. And I worry about exactly that, not consciously, but look, you sit in the CEO's office. It doesn't mean that you're inside the business. It's actually seeking out information and analyses that reinforce the story that he's telling the investors, which is an incredible feel-good experience, because he tells the investors and then the stock price goes up and then he feels good and they love him and he loves them and he loves the business and they love the business. But I just wonder if it's diverging from reality, which is just a...
Well, it's weaponizing confirmation bias.
With inadvertently, yes.
Yes, perhaps inadvertently. One of the things that is so distressing is I genuinely believe in ethics, but I also do know that ordinary people who find themselves in certain situations will behave in ways that later appear deeply unethical. But if you look at the average person and the incentives that are in place, not everybody's a saint easily. And this is why things like cultural analysis and understanding by investors of the long-term incentives for capital allocation within a business, the incentives for stewardship as opposed to quarterly results, I believe are one of the bedrocks on which you can build a safe portfolio.
So I think he's a Nobel Prize winner, Robert Shiller, has pulled out, he's now got a book out on the topic, and the subject is effectively narrative economics. And I think that I am not a storyteller, and certainly not a good storyteller, but I wish I was, and I wish I understood how stories work, because it seems that stories take a hold in the mind, and the story might be true or not. But the right stories kind of sit there and are part of the environment, such that once a certain narrative takes hold in the marketplace, in an organization, somebody can come up with a competing narrative, and it's worse than dismissed. It's just they're speaking gobbledygook. And it seems to me that part of this cultural diversity that you're talking about is allowing for competing stories of what is actually happening to coexist with each other. But they tend not to coexist.
Yes, and I'm sure you're familiar with Thomas Kuhn's book, The Foundations of Scientific Revolutions. And he looked at why did it take so long after the data was available for people to overthrow the Ptolemaic worldview and adopt the Copernican worldview about the idea that the Earth revolves around the sun rather than the reverse. And what has to happen is that the prevailing paradigm, as he called it, that's why everybody adopted the word paradigm, that the prevailing paradigm endures for a long time in the face of anomalies, because people first ignore the anomalies, and then when the anomalies get too big, the first thing they do is blame the instruments.
Right.
And because, of course, this darn thing is broken. But when you study the history of science, you realize that that's where the real breakthroughs come. Einstein came up with relativity because I believe it was the orbit of the planet Mercury was something like 0.3 seconds late compared to what Newtonian physics would have predicted. And most people just said, oh, that's an instrument question. And Einstein is the guy who said, wait, if Newtonian physics are true, that shouldn't be happening. So let's interrogate that anomaly. So one of the things that, if you don't want to read investment books every day, and maybe you don't even want to read intelligence books every day, the history of science and the logic of scientific discoveries is a very fruitful avenue. It's a very fruitful that I think investors can go down and feel like they're escaping Wall Street, goodness knows, but they're probably gaining styles of thinking that will stand them in good stead as value investors.
I think, a book that I was just discussing, what's the series, I don't even if you know you call it a book, a piece of literature from the Jewish tradition is the Talmud, which, coursing through that work, there are multiple narratives at multiple levels of analysis. And so they're preserving the minority view on Jewish law, but there are also competing views in there of the personalities of the rabbis who are arguing. And one of the takeaways for me just in real time is how important it is to preserve just different narratives and to kind of like, if you see another narrative not emerging, if it's expressed, you need to nurture it and develop a habit of nurturing even wrong views.
Yes. And as I understand it, the Talmud and the body of literature around it even do more, if I may say, Guy, as a WASP whose family makes pork sausage.
You grew up on the Upper East Side. You grew up on the Upper East Side of New York. Even in New York, even if you're Catholic, you're Jewish, you know?
Fair enough. It not only preserves dissenting voices, but it literally can present on the same page the evolution of dissenting voices over multiple generations. So it's impossible to look at a text and believe it as one pure thing, because you can already see that not only have 20 people disagreed, but 20 people have disagreed over several centuries.
Yeah.
And there's been a, you're in dialogue constantly with it. Let me just see.
Yeah, pull out one of those books. So for those of you who are listening on a podcast, I should describe Milo as he goes and pulls out a book. So he's on a TV screen or a Zoom call.
It's also done in the Quran. I was going to show you a page. I have a page in the Quran in which there's the Quran page, and then there are written in a sideways slant, beautifully, in beautiful calligraphy, commentaries on those particular verses. So this is a part of the tradition of people of the book. And just to, as a segue into perhaps where you wanted to go, technology is changing how we interact with ideas, because media and the experience of reading a printed book is very different from reading on a phone. And getting your financial news from a printed newspaper delivered to your house once a day is very different from getting it from a Bloomberg terminal. And people underestimate the degree to which we shape our technologies, and then technology starts shaping us in important ways.
Yeah, and so I didn't. So everyone, Milo's got just a beautiful library of books behind him, encased in beautiful wood. For those of you who are not able to see, but before we get onto the salacious topic of geopolitics, we should spend some time with Marshall McLuhan. And so if it's true that the digital retrieves the medieval, and maybe you'll take a moment to explain to the listener who's perhaps never heard that idea, you can flesh it out. But that's a really depressing thought. I don't want to go to the medieval.
Well, the important thing is to realize we no longer live in the modern age.
So Milo, slow down and unpack that. In this case, not just for me, for the audience, but also for me. We no longer live in the modern age. That's really disturbing to me. I'm deeply uncomfortable. I don't want to believe that you're true.
Me too. I do not embrace this. I actually believe profoundly, as we've discussed, in essentially the ideas of the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment was very much a print phenomenon. It is about written text. And just to use my favorite example when teaching of how Marshall McLuhan's insight that the medium is the message, that the medium is more important, that the technology by which you receive information is more important than any piece of information you receive, because that technology shapes what information you get and how you get it. Well, let me give you an example. The most famous political speech in American history is probably the Gettysburg Address. Abraham Lincoln gave it in 1863, and we don't have a photograph of it because Lincoln was expected to speak, like most speakers at the time, for about 2 hours. They would do the full Fidel Castro. His warm-up act did the full Fidel Castro. But Lincoln had spent the Civil War to that point in the situation room of the White House, noticing how the telegraph and information flowing in by telegraph was shaping what was appearing in newspapers. And so Lincoln wanted to give a speech that would be noted verbatim. Instead of having all the reporters at the dedication of the cemetery explain the Civil War, Lincoln understood the new medium of the telegraph and wanted to come up with a speech that would be reported verbatim. He tailored his message to the new medium. So he only wrote 260 some words. Now, Those words were linear and rational and elegant. I'll give you the first sentence. 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now that's linear and rational and complex. It makes some biblical allusions. It's really elegant, but I would submit to you that in important ways, that's a 19th century tweet, because indeed, the Gettysburg Address was taken down by reporters and reported on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line verbatim. In other words, Trump, in some ways, mastered Twitter the same way that Lincoln had mastered the telegraph. He understood the new media environment and he used it. And by the way, he had a high, squeaky voice. And he was ugly. So he would never have been elected president because of the media in the radio age. But I can name some politicians who were pretty good at the radio. You might have heard of some of them. I know not everybody listening is a political scientist, but let's see if you've heard of some of them. Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, Benito Mussolini. I don't think you get fascism without the radio, without these powerful speakers coming into your house, which they didn't do when you just got the newspaper. And by the time I'm joining the Marine Corps, who does America elect as their president? Ronald Reagan, a movie and TV actor. We got it. Well, now we've entered a different world in which all the information most people get comes through what we still call phones. Of course, they're not phones, they're a lot more than phones. And that's shaping who gets listened to and what messages get sent. And I have tried several times to reformulate 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. I've tried to suit it to a smartphone, but you know, those emojis, even if you use the pool emoji, you can't get them. We can't send sophisticated political messages anymore.
Actually, so two people come to mind that maybe deserve to be studied more. So one is James Clear of Atomic Habits. Another is David Perel. If I may be getting this wrong, and I hope I'm not repeating an urban legend, but, and so if somebody hears this and can either confirm or deny it to me, please get in touch with me. Twitter's a pretty good place, and tell me that either I'm right or wrong and send me a link. But if I understand correctly, James Clear composed his book Atomic Habits on Twitter, and he wrote it as a series of tweets. And now that the tweet limit, the character limit has been expanded on Twitter, another person who teaches writing online, somebody called David Perel, one of the things that I believe I've heard him argue is that it's an extraordinary discipline to compose your thoughts in a series of tweets. And what he would say is that it forces a profound discipline on your thinking because you have to communicate it in a series of short thoughts. So, you know, those are two people who it seems have mastered Twitter for a positive thing. Both of those people are disseminating insight and knowledge in a wonderful way. It's really disturbing, obviously, that people like Donald Trump mastered Twitter to motivate people to take action, to vote for him, or to do other things in a way that has kind of tapped into our basest human instincts, which I guess is why you're talking about the digital retrieving the medieval. Somehow the linear sentences and perhaps even radio and perhaps even television but certainly text and then radio were oriented towards contemplation, not being reactive, and leaving television aside, because I think a lot of television today is extraordinarily reactive. or generates reactions. Certainly the social media, well, I guess your point is that it doesn't just generate reaction, it generates irrational action. People get enraged by something they've seen on social media and then go and vote for somebody that if they were to be more considered, it's, I imagine, and you'll now correct me or elaborate, that that's the path by which the digital retrieves the medieval, cutting through the whole sort of developed mind, neocortex, all of these subtle mechanisms that we have for evaluating information, going straight down to the raw reptilian emotions that we all have underlying all of that.
Yes. First of all, I don't know James Clear, but it sounds like I would agree with much of what he says. It does impose discipline, but so does having to work in a sonnet format. And I would suggest that as much as we like Shakespeare's sonnets, we also like what Shakespeare produced in blank verse, and that the profundity of thought, of some thoughts, are easier to convey via King Lear than Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day, but they're limitations of the constraints, and that especially conveying linear, non-emotional, rational ideas are more easily done without the constraints of Twitter. So it is a high emotion environment. But what I really mean by digital retrieves the medieval is, in some sense, deeper, because there are psychological effects. One of McLuhan's main points was there are psychological effects on people who use certain communication technologies every day. And that often you can find strange echoes in the past of the sorts of societies that are arising because of a new technology. And if you read a book like Barbara Tuchman's A Distant Mirror, you find out, gosh, in the 14th century, I believe the subtitle is The Calamitous 14th Century, so I agree with you, I'm not thrilled about this, but all our institutions are under pressure because of digital technologies. And if I look at certain features of medieval life, I admit I see parallels in our own life. In the medieval world, you had a transnational aristocracy of fabulously wealthy people who felt often they had more in common with their fellow aristocrats than they did with the mere peasants. And they would meet once a year at Davos. Oh, no, that's now. If you're thinking about the growth of inequality, certainly inequality wouldn't have surprised the medieval world.
What were the technologies? So I understand that the pathway I don't understand, but I can imagine what kinds of pathways are being exploited by digital technologies to allow the medieval to emerge. But what was it about the medieval world? What technologies was it at the time that allowed these characteristics to emerge?
I think it had partly to do with what amounts to a scribal sensibility, that not everybody could write, but those educated people all spoke a single language of handwritten pre-printed books, right? So printing existed, but for example, there were no agreed upon spellings and things like that, in the same way that now people are much less.
So you're talking about a world of a pre-Gutenberg printing press world of scrolls and edicts from rulers that are written in Latin, and so an insider can read and understand, in the same way that only an insider to Davos can understand the thoughts and minds of the people who are making decisions at the world central banks, for example.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and Gutenberg is that, in fact. One of McLuhan's hardest but best books is indeed called The Gutenberg Galaxy, that traces from this moment. First of all, the printed book is the first mass-produced, machine-made, identical object in the world. So there are elements of Henry Ford's adoption of the assembly line that have their roots in the sorts of thinking like, oh gosh, we have a machine that makes the same object over and over. How else could we use that? But As soon as printing takes off, the price of books falls. So Latin begins to fall out of use as the universal language of educated people. And you see nationalism start to grow. The books are printed in German and in French and in other things. You get the formation of nation states. And of course, you also get very quickly the Protestant Reformation, where people like Martin Luther are saying everybody should read the Bible. But you can't even assert that, and not everybody could afford a Bible until you have the printed book. So you have a period of enormous uproar because of this new medium, the printed book. And the phrase digital retrieves the medieval is partly simply to convey that we are right at the beginning of profound institutional, cultural, and social change, equal to that period when suddenly everybody could afford books. Because over half the world, I believe over half the world is now connected to, half the world's citizens are connected to the internet in some sense, and about a third of them are connected to some form of social media. And that will have huge institutional consequences for investors, for governments, and for what people expect from one another and their communities and their identities.
And so this is going to, now I am going to segue into, it's kind of like salacious for me. So, you know, the most influential, it seems to me, medieval player to emerge on the world stage is our friend Vladimir Putin, who has dragged, you know, he's busted through the system of nation states and non-interference and respect of borders and resolution of disputes through non-violent means. And he's just gone and decided that he wants to do a land grab. And so he's, in a certain way, the ultimate medieval figure in today's world, perhaps not the only one, but certainly a very important one, or one worth paying attention to. And so my first question to you, I guess, is, especially for those of us who don't want the world to descend into a medieval land grab as he is doing, that means that Putin must fail. But, you know, if I take Bill Browder's idea that irrational actions usually mean that you don't have all the information, Vladimir Putin is many things, but he's not dumb, and he certainly reads the world's press. So, you know, what is he thinking, and, you know, can he win, and can we prevent a descent of the world into the medieval? I mean, that certainly accelerates it.
So, big picture, we all think about the impact of digital technologies and the disturbance of our assumptions and institutions, because we see it so much in our electoral systems and democracies. But what I would suggest is that digital technologies are having an equally disruptive effect on autocracies. And if you're trying to understand why a man like Vladimir Putin is building a personalist autocracy the way he has and behaving the way he does, or if, frankly, if you're trying to decide why Xi Jinping has decided that, actually, how about I just get to be emperor? That's another, simply a retrieval. Oh, and by the way, his big trade initiative has a medieval name, the Silk Route, right? He's effectively, digital's retrieving the medieval in China too. So don't think it's just us having to worry about Trump, et cetera. Digital technologies are putting pressure on every society that's experiencing them. It's just, it works out differently between autocracies and democracies. So that's the first macro point. The point you're looking for, though, I think, is Vladimir Putin's most recent set of actions an indicator that we're headed towards headed away from the world we all expected? I used to say I expected the world of Star Trek. Remember the original Star Trek? There's a World Federation, and the captain's an American, but gosh, you know, there's Mr. Chekhov and Mr. Sulu. So we kind of expected to be in charge, but I don't think we're headed towards the world of Star Trek. I think a lot of the institutions like the United Nations are under great pressure. And what many people call the globalist project, as much as we might all want to believe we're headed towards a governable world with someone in charge, we might not be. And I believe Putin's actions is evidence of that, but only a small part of the evidence of that. Can he be defeated, though, today in Ukraine? I passionately hope and believe that he can. And I have, living at our house, at my mother-in-law's house, we have a Ukrainian mother, two of her sons, and her mother-in-law. And one of the boys gave me this plastic giraffe I'm holding up just the other day. And you see me, seven. All he wants to do is go home. And so I feel the war very closely.
Yeah. Many Poles do. I think probably all Poles do. You have something like 3 million or 4 million refugees, which is something like 20% of the Polish population.
It's about 10%.
Right.
And there hasn't always been great blood between Poland and Ukraine, but there is now. Can we win? Yes, we can. When we win, however, we being the West, does that mean that the world's suddenly safe for democracy? I'm afraid it doesn't. It is entirely possible that one of two scenarios arises, and investors do need to be thinking this through. Either Russia stays together, wounded and angry, a de facto number two to China, not just in Russia itself, but also in Central Asia. And that's not healthy. But it might be more stable than the alternative, which is the scenario that used to be discussed in the 90s, which is that Russia fails, really fails, and we end up with a situation like 1905 or 1917, where there's a realistic chance that Russia breaks up. And then suddenly we have Yugoslavia across 11 time zones with thousands of nuclear weapons. I don't think that's likely. If Vladimir Putin goes, whatever the Russian system as it's currently configured vomits up, is not going to be noticeably more humanistic than Vladimir, I fear. I love Russian culture.
Yeah, it's the country
of Tolstoy,
Chekhov, Pushkin, you know.
You can't have the ballet. You can't imagine modern music.
Yeah.
You can't imagine a lot of things without Russia. But right now, Russia has an enormous journey that it hasn't even begun to take. And the mere removal of Vladimir Putin will only begin a long road back to what I would call the West for Russia, which is like where I would like Russia to return. One day I would like Russia to be like Canada, cold to the north and friendly.
We have some amazing candidates. We have Vladimir Karamurza, and we have Alexei Navalny, who are ready to start that project the minute they're let out of jail. But,
yes.
But just to go back to military strategy for a second, There seems to me, and I'm in favor of, you know, I'm in favor of asking the American Navy if they can just sink the blacks. So you know, I go to bed every night or wake up in the morning in the shower, and I want the American Navy to sink the Black Sea fleet of Russia. I'd like all Russian ships not to be allowed to pass through the straits there, and you know, that's what I want. I want all that equipment going right away. But the answer is, or an answer that is given, is that it doesn't matter what we do, because Russia can continuously escalate all the way up to nuclear weapons. And they're willing, they've done it, they've used all sorts of heinous weapons in Syria. And so, you know, how do we win such a battle? Because whatever we send them, so the last I read is that we're sending them missile systems that can fire 50 miles, and people of my ilk say, God, I wish they could just stick a couple of missiles onto the Kremlin and get them to change their minds. But whatever we do, they have an escalatory response all the way till the unthinkable. So, and if they get to define what is a threat to the regime. And for them, a threat to the regime is a threat to Russia. And so how are we ever going to get them to change their minds?
We're going to hope the Russians themselves change their regime. And I would remind you that in our lifetime, Guy, the Russian people have changed their regime. It was slower than we all wanted, but they did do it. But I agree with you. They have escalation dominance. And General Mattis, a famous Marine, was once asked, what keeps you up at night? And he said, absolutely nothing. It's my job to keep other people up at night. I believe the West ought to be just that little bit more assertive.
So you used a phrase that I've never heard before, but sounds important. They have escalation dominance. And what it brings up for me is, I want somebody in the West who, you know, they talk about this in Israel. You need them to believe that you're slightly crazy and capable of irrational things, even if you're deeply rational. Escalation dominance is the willingness to reach for a bigger weapon faster, it seems to me.
And yes, there are people say, what if Russia were to drop a nuclear weapon in, say, Western Poland or in Eastern Poland? What would we do?
Yeah.
There's a school of thought that says we do massive conventional and cyber strike. That's one option. Option two is they do one, we do one. But there's another school of thought.
That, by the way, is a tit for tat.
Right.
And has been proven to work in many circumstances.
In game theory, absolutely. Yeah. Escalation dominance would advocate they do one, we do two.
So this question came up with an investor. So there's a very real, there's certainly the risk of a nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States has increased probably manyfold. It was an infinitesimally small number, but it is increased. Because I'm a close observer of Israel, have seen, and I just see it from the outside. I don't know the decision making, but there's this careful calculus of reacting to a provocation, which is usually a volley of missiles from a terrorist-controlled territory into Israel. The hawks like me want to overreact. The calibrated reaction that is sufficient to establish deterrence, but signal as soon as possible that we should go back to peace and quiet.
A good Israeli friend of mine, though, calls that the acceptance that you're going to have to go in and mow the grass every few years.
Right.
And, you know, okay, now we got to go back to Gaza and mow the grass. I'm not sure that's the best long-term outcome, even for the people in Gaza. And I would suggest that the best long-term outcome, even for Russia, might be for the world to take the sorts of chances you and I are advocating, which is make it perfectly clear that you might be crazy, but we're more powerful and just maybe as crazy as you.
Yeah, or even a little more. And that's where perhaps if Donald Trump would be president, he might have had an edge, because he does have the capacity to create that. But I want to bring up something, and this is probably going to be...
That's actually an interesting point, and I hesitate to say profoundly comforting. But I guess if what the world needs is a crazy group of leaders, then maybe we should all look forward to the elections that I'm currently dreading.
Which ones are those?
The American midterms, not to even mention the next presidential race.
Right. We'll discover then whether Trumpism is a spent political force or not. I've put that thought away for now. I want to bring up something that is really, it's a question for me that I don't understand. I do follow Edward Luttwak, and in one of the few conversations that I had with him, he explained to me how the West holding Israel back in the 67 war from invading and imposing their will on the Egyptian capital meant that war was not properly won. And he asked the question, he posited that the history of the Middle East would have been different if Israel had been allowed to properly win that war, impose its will, roll its tanks into Cairo, help the broad mass of the Arab population to understand that they had been defeated militarily and now they had to engage with the Jewish state. But then when I see him, his ideas on this war with Russia, he's advocating polls as soon as possible.
Yes, one of the articles, to those listeners who don't know Edward Luttbach, one of the best places to start. He has an ear for titles. There's a wonderful essay he wrote for the magazine Foreign Affairs called "Give War a Chance." And he makes the case that it's actually immoral at times to stop wars, that what is needed is a clear winner and a clear loser. And that is what prevents things from building up, like Israel having in the Gaza Strip or in Lebanon, the generation after generation of bitter people who live on a myth that they weren't actually defeated.
Yeah.
I can't explain why, in this context, he's suddenly decided to channel his inner Metternich and start to talk about the need for plebiscites and trading land for peace. I would like to see a decisive defeat, a clear and decisive defeat of the Russians and the restoration of sovereign Ukraine territory in toto.
Revisionists, I call them revisionists, I don't think they understand the incredible, I think, moral and brave decision that was taken to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki for the benefit of Japanese. I mean, the predictions were that if United States would have had to end the war by invading Japan, based on the experiences, I think, in the invasion of Okinawa, they were talking about a million deaths on both sides. And
I'll be honest, I thought the figure was a million deaths just on the Allies.
So
it would have
horrific. And so the atomic bomb was horrific. But it seems to me that the West would need to be provoked orders of magnitude greater than it has been provoked for that to be a safe political decision. And I don't know what that action, the equivalent action that just says, stop, we're done, we're not doing this anymore, which is effectively what the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki yes. did.
And of course, and I did a call with this, thanks to some people you put me in touch with in Zurich in clusters the last time around. Of course, the people watching this are the Chinese and the Taiwanese. And so the actions we're taking as Westerners, as Europeans, as Americans, will echo. And you can argue that the greatest number of good for the greatest number of people is a much harder line in Ukraine, exactly to send the message to the Chinese that the nation of Taiwan, if it is ever to be unified, and I will not say reunified because it has never been in recorded history, never quite been fully Chinese. So if Taiwan were ever to be unified with the mainland, it would be done through peaceful means. And any attempt to bully Taiwan into unifying with the mainland would be met with extraordinary force. So believe me, the Chinese are watching. And that's an argument to not make things easy and provide off-ramps for Mr. Putin.
Yeah, so we could go down. I mean, it's so interesting. Maybe we should set up another call just to talk about that. And I don't envy any of the decision makers on our side. I'm not saying that those decisions are easy, and it probably would lose me a lot of sleep. I mean, who wants to go down in history as being the person who edged the world towards a nuclear exchange? And who wants to live the life of somebody who has to be, who has to establish escalatory dominance? I mean, you know, that's a pretty nasty person who says, you know, it's a Clint Eastwood line, make my day, you know?
Yes, but I would also say, against our point of view, Guy, the other strength of the West is our alliance system. And you can think of NATO as a convoy. It may be slow, but it's safe. But it's only as fast as its slowest ship. And another form of escalation dominance is keeping the coalition together. So it's a very passive-aggressive form of violence. But if you're China and you're looking around and say, let's see, on the friend list, we've got North Korea, Pakistan often.
Yeah.
At least you can rent Pakistan, if not own it. Whereas the West has this alliance structure. So in some ways, we've already escalated. We're escalated because we've got the most friends. And Putin, who are his friends, he's got a bunch of people neutral.
Yeah, we've added friends. That's kind
of... Well, again, he's got rented friends as well.
Yeah. But no, Finland. Yeah, for us, Finland and Sweden are added friends.
Right, exactly. Exactly. The Baltic is now a NATO lake, and he's doubled the length of territory he has with NATO. And Sweden has wonderful submarines. And Finland has more artillery pieces than France, Germany, and the UK combined.
Wow.
This is a very capable nation, 200 miles from Moscow and much closer to Leningrad.
I would say that,
St. Petersburg.
You know, funnily enough, I was probably a lukewarm European integrationist. I loved the travel opportunities, and I loved I was very happy with the free market, but actually used to watch videos of Nigel Farage in the European Parliament and thought they were very, very entertaining until the UK actually left. And it's only, and especially now with this war with Russia, I've really come to understand deeply and really appreciate the extraordinary achievements of the European Union. And I guess part of that is NATO. I realize they're separate international organizations, but this amazing idea that there will under no circumstances be a situation where member states of the European Union or member states of NATO settle a dispute by force or by violence, and that every dispute, and there will be strong rivalry and strong competition, but all of those resources will have to go into competition in Brussels, in the rules, in trade, and what is such a shame is that nobody was stopping Russia from wooing the eastern parts of Ukraine into their orbit through all nonviolent means, which is effectively all we in the West are asking for. We don't mind any of Russia's claims to eastern Ukraine in the same way that we don't mind both the United Kingdom's and Ireland's claims to Northern Ireland. We just, you know, and we say, go ahead, set about. And I had this wonderful experience visiting Northern Ireland where this an Irish guy said, you know, he looks at me in the eye and he took us on a visit to the IRA and a former IRA. He said, I want a united Ireland, I don't support violence, and I'm going to do everything I can to convince Protestant unionists that their best future is in a united Ireland, and I'm going to make them feel comfortable with the Queen and their Union Jacks and all of those things. It was just a beautiful, beautiful idea, and that's what is so sickening about what seems to have been lost. And that, for me, is what the Ukrainians are fighting for.
Yes, and they died for Europe. They were the first people to die for Europe in 2014, and they're doing it now. And that's why I feel very strongly that as much as we read about all the weapons that might go there, it would be the most powerful weapon of all would be an explicit, clear path to European Union membership, even if it's slow. And it should be slow. It's for the best of the Ukrainians if it's slow, but clear and unmistakable direction of travel. People need to know what they're fighting for. They're not fighting for a second-rate institution. But if I may, one of the more interesting things I've come across since the war started is the idea that the war in Ukraine will create a crisis for European identity that is just beginning. And that is that in the same way that we hear about American exceptionalism, this idea that America has a special role and message for the world, Europe started with that message with a exceptional vision too. It was to be the place that was about soft power, that was beyond geopolitics. And certainly since 1989, it had built an identity around, we don't do hard power, we don't do geopolitics. Now that that has been decisively disproved on the European continent, sorry, like it or not, you do geopolitics.
Yeah, I don't like that.
where does Europe go next? What exactly is it promising?
I want to get back to the Shire. You know, I just, you know, I'll close with this thought, because this is fascinating, and we can't decide anything, but, and I'll express this probably many more times because I don't think enough people have heard it. I want politics to be boring. I think that people like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson and other demagogues, which is not a very nice term for them, but all of that ability to entertain, distract, draw attention is great for the movie theater, the theater. They should be entertainers. And, you know, when now I see Nigel Farage with, I think Herman from Rompuy is his name. And Nigel, this is a famous clip that you can see on YouTube. And Nigel Farage is saying, well, who are you? When I arrived in Switzerland, I knew the names of all seven federal councillors. And I think I could probably dig out four or five now, but I really don't care anymore. They're not important. We want politicians who are kind of semi-academic administrators. They're really very boring. They sit in meetings and they figure out what the best solution is to the problem of living together as humanity. And I think the European Union exemplifies that. So I really hope that we can get back to the Shire. You know, we're not in Kansas anymore, but I want to get back.
I would suggest that digital technologies are changing people, and that ultimately the audience creates the artist, and that people like Donald Trump are symptoms, not causes. And that whether we like it or not, the characteristic of digital media with its high emotionality and its limited textual reasoning is going to make the world more like Donald Trump, not less like Donald Trump. I don't like it, but I don't think you could run for dog catcher of Zurich and not model your campaign on aspects of Trump. And I would say to investors and business people, we all talked about disruption and Clayton Christensen and how we love disruption. Well, you want disruption, you're going to get it, because Trump is Uber. What did Uber do? It used digital technologies to go over the heads of incumbent service providers to talk to customers who felt underserved. What did Trump do? He used digital technology to go over the head of incumbent service providers, which are existing political parties, to speak to customers who felt underserved. And then he hijacked one of the taxi companies. I'll grant that. But we have to accept that in some sense, they're a symptom, but they're also a safety valve. And the strength of our system is that unlike a power vertical like Putin's Russia, and unlike Emperor for Life Xi, our system does have these safety valves. So let's try to shape a better future, accepting that, sorry, we're not in Kansas anymore.
And it's all digital. That's a project. I look forward to hearing more from you on as to how we do that. It will be a bitter pill to swallow that if we cannot return to Kansas, and I'm not giving up on that, but I hope we can get to something close. Milo, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. And you know, this, the last hour, more than it's almost 2 hours, I believe, has slipped by almost unnoticed. If people want to have heard this and they want to hear more from you, I'll let you describe your books, and then maybe you can say how people can get in touch with you if they want to.
Guy, you're very kind, and I've enjoyed it enormously as well. I always do. And I meant that finding you by chance on the internet and your generosity in inviting me to Value X has made my life and the life of my family and others whom I've known immeasurably better. If people want to get in touch with me, the best way is Twitter, at Inveniam, which means I shall find in Latin, because Hannibal supposedly said Inveniam viam aut facium, which means I shall find a way or make one. Of course, he would have said it in Punic rather than Latin, but we won't go there. If people want to know more about my ideas, find me on Twitter and get in touch. Or don't read my book. My book's boring. But Matthew Saeed wrote a wonderful book called Rebel Ideas very recently. And I figure prominently in chapter one where he talks about the importance of diversity for analyzing complex problems. Diversity is a pain, but it's also worth the pain. It gives you an edge. Otherwise, I'm on LinkedIn too, and I'm always happy, as I started this conversation, the power of getting in touch with strangers, reaching out and asking the right questions, and meeting people is one of the best things you can do. And so thank you, Guy, for this opportunity, and thank you for being you and doing stuff like this.
Yeah, you say some kind words. Thank you, Milo. I've said this repeatedly, but I think it's one of the ways we create a better world is by not all of the internet is reactive and emotive. And for example, when I decide to have a conversation like this with Milo, which I deeply appreciate, because for those of you who are interested in ValueX, we wouldn't get this much time together. So I've really enjoyed this time with you. But by putting this conversation, allowing anybody to eavesdrop on the conversation, we're actually enhancing a more contemplative view of the world. And we're also attracting like-minded people from around the world, anywhere they might be, into our orbit, which is kind of, as you can see from the story, how Milo and I came into each other's orbit. And it goes both ways, Milo. I've enormously enjoyed. So you know, I seek to curate a group of people at ValueX that is diverse for the reasons that you, Milo, have given. I think that we can do a lot more in terms of diversity. It's a diverse group, but it could be more diverse. But in any case, thank you, Milo, for joining me. I'll give you the last word, seeing as I just rambled a little bit.
My last words are simply thank you, and thank the team that I know stands behind you and helps make this podcast and other wonderful events you hold and do possible. Mm-hmm. Take nothing away from you, but I also know there's a team back there.
There's an awesome best team.
And thanks to them.
Thank you, Milo. And that includes Chantal, Mariana, and David, who helped me on a daily basis.
Take care, Guy. My best to everybody.
Thank you.